Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap with me, Andy, and Mike Donahue. Mike, how are you doing?
Good, Andy. How are you?
Good. Mike can be... I can be found... I never give my own context, which seems stupid. So, you can read my newsletter on pointlessexercise.com. It's one of those subscription newsletters, but it's free because right about the time I was going to start charging people, sports just went away. So we'll worry about that at a later date. So for now it's free. Sign up for it. What the hell?
Good business plan.
You can find the podcasts at the easiest place. Just go to DeCipio.com and they're all there for you. And then I'm on Twitter at DeCipio.com. You have to spell it all out. And then Mike is available on the Twitters at HueCub, H-U-E. CUB.
Is there anybody that arrives at this podcast not from Twitter?
Yeah, because there are people who just subscribe to it.
Okay. Yeah, pardon my ignorance.
There are hundreds. There are hundreds of people who subscribe.
When I try to track down like the podcast that you do with Pusateri, I just go to your Twitter.
We tweet it out then... incessantly. Yes, this is actually these podcasts are I would say relatively popular. We are not screaming into the void. There are people who subscribe and enjoy them. I would say, given the podcasts nobody listens to are the ones on The Athletic. Because the genius is there. Now, I shouldn't make fun of them because they were the same genius as the ones who hired me and paid me for 3 years to write for them. When they started the podcast, they put them behind the paywall. You had to be an Athletic subscriber to get to the podcast, and now they're not behind the paywall anymore, and people are like, aren't those the ones you have to pay for? So this is brilliant. You should always have used the podcast to drive to get people familiar with the writers so they want to sign up for right. But I think they were worried that the writers would talk about all the good stuff that's in The Athletic and you'd be like, well, I don't need to read it, they just said it to me. So anyway.
Yeah, you'll be proud to know, Andy, that in an act of solidarity, I canceled my Athletic subscription when they cut you loose in the spring. Well, but nice. Then I learned it was paid for through November, so I still have it.
Oh, you were boycotting.
No, I haven't re-upped, but it was like, all right, well, they weren't going to refund it. I'm like, all right, I'll keep it till November, but I'm out, and this is why.
So I still have it. But
well, I imagine you would.
But if they have an EDU... email address you have access to, you can get the college student rate, and that's what I get. Because they made me pay for it while I was working for them.
Can you write it off at least?
I asked for two things. I think John thought I was kidding. I said, can I get a t-shirt, and can I get a comp subscription to the site? I got neither.
So, not even a t-shirt, huh?
The check's always cleared, though, so I guess I shouldn't complain. Yeah. Sometimes they took a while, but they always cleared. So I got that going for me, which is nice. Anyway, enough of that. People don't come here for Athletic bashing. They come here for Marquee bashing, but that's not even the right podcast for me.
Let's bash the Bears.
So the Bears, the 5-2 Bears, who, if Denny Green were alive, that would have been a great game for him to have banged on the podium and said, the Bears are who we thought they were, except he could have been excited instead of mad because they pretty much were exactly what we thought they were going to be.
Yeah.
But this is Saints week.
Saints week. Who dat? Who dat?
I don't know if you remember the Saints game from last year. The great Teddy Bridgewater filling in for Drew Brees. Mm-hmm. Now, you said you didn't listen to the Bear podcast, so I can ask you this because we talked about it on that one with me and Mike Pusateri. Mm-hmm. Do you remember how many yards the Bears ran for in the Saints game last year?
I mean, I don't, but I can make an educated guess considering the data that Nagy has provided us. What I think about that game last year is that it seemed to be the first departure that the Bears team that had made the playoffs the year before really might not make it back, because Bridgewater was a fill-in, and it was a long afternoon. The Bears made the score close. So I'm going to just say 32 yards. It was something ridiculous, wasn't it?
It was about half that.
Okay.
They ran the ball seven times for 17 yards. Seven times.
I remember that now.
They were down 36-10 with 2 minutes and 54 seconds left. Final score, 36-25. Made it seem like they didn't get their ass kicked, but they got their ass kicked.
Yeah. He's good at that. So that's like the Colts game a few weeks ago.
Well, and even the one
garbage touchdown.
Even the one on Monday. If if Javon Wims, if Nick Foles gets that ball near Javon Wims, he scores a touchdown. They lose by a touchdown, and people who didn't watch the game are like, "Oh, it was close." Like, no, right. It wasn't. They were never threatening to win. Right. At least once, Tashaun Gibson Sr. decided to bat a ball out of the air instead of catching it.
Right. Thought it was a pinata, I think.
So anyway, that's the Rams. We talked about the Rams last week and Merlin Olsen and.
Right.
Father Murphy and all that.
The phoniness of, that is the fearsome foursome, if I could keep the alliteration going.
So I got a gift this week, a literal gift. On this podcast and on the other podcast, I have bemoaned the fact that you cannot find the 2006 NFC Championship game on the YouTubes.
Your white whale.
Yes. And a reader, he direct messaged you and me.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I think he just tweeted at us.
He
just tweeted at us and said, I got a copy of it. Do you want it? Now, it could go horribly wrong. This could be Hunter Biden.
Meet me behind the Walmart.
Trying to send me a virus that was just going to take. But here's the thing. I don't worry about identity theft or people getting my bank. I don't have any money. So honestly, if you want to pay some of my, you want to steal my identity and pay off some of my bills, I'm more than happy to let you do that.
Griff better.
So I'm like, sure. But he made it. It was easy. He set up a Gmail. He put it on his G drive and I pulled it off.
Uh-huh.
So I have it now. So then I thought, as a benevolent service to the people who follow here, I'm like, I'm going to take this. I'm going to put it on YouTube and then people can watch it. And that'd be great. I'll put it on YouTube. We can all watch it. And I'm going to write. I remember the name of my column. I couldn't even think of the feature that I have for the review where I take old games and make fun of them. I thought this would be great.
Right.
I'll put the game up. Everybody can watch it. Then I'll write a column, make fun of it, and we'll all enjoy it. Oh, it'll be great.
Right.
So last night I started uploading it. He sent me four files, one for each quarter. So I'm uploading the first quarter. It gets uploaded. I start to upload the second quarter. I get an email from YouTube that the NFL has already claimed a copyright violation and that, they've blocked the – nobody can see the file. So I wave the white flag and I can't put it on YouTube. So sorry.
That didn't take long.
Everybody's going to have to just come over
once
COVID is over. I'll put a screen up in the backyard and everybody will come watch it.
I'll be there.
Yeah.
But how do the games that we're all able to, you know, see, whether in truncated form or highlights, how are we able to see them? I mean, what deal would you have had to cut or the guy that sent it to you? I'm sure he probably tried to post it too and got shot down. I'm assuming.
Yeah, I don't know that he ever tried to post it. Sorry, my wife is going to drink my beer. Here.
What is for?
I don't know if you have to be a NFL partner. Somehow have some kind of relationship with the NFL and then they let you post the thing. I don't know. But I certainly don't. They said no.
Are they not listening to these podcasts?
They should. I mean, it's free advertising for them. We say nice things about them all the time. So it didn't work. But anyway, I now have it. So I can watch it. I'm going to write that column. It's going to be very exciting. Had I get my shit together, this would have been a really good week for the column to go up. You know, the week of the Saints game.
You've got time. If you could push it out tomorrow, I suppose.
Yeah, it's not happening. Because I want to... No. First, I just...
You don't want to
I have a feeling it. I'm going to watch the game the first time and not write anything down. Just be like, oh, I don't remember that. Oh, look at that. I didn't remember that.
You kind of have to reabsorb it because honestly, you know, I know that part of our trick is recalling all kinds of obscure things from years ago. I struggle the more recent you get, just as a matter of me getting older, but also part of my ability to recall games from 30 years ago is just over the years I've been able to sort of catalog them further and further. So it's harder for me to sometimes catalog the more recent events. I was at that Saints game. I remember Reggie Bush diving into the end zone. I remember the Bears losing at halftime, and I'm pretty sure I was relatively sober. I just don't, you know, and I know they won the championship. It was snowy out. I was there with my brother and my cousin. It was we were both at the game in '86 too. So, but I couldn't tell you, more than five facts that happened in that game unless I really drilled down. So, I'll defer to you.
So, okay, the Bears weren't actually losing at halftime.
My bad.
But the Saints scored right. The Bears had gone up 16-0, and the Saints scored It looked like they were going to have a 16-0 lead at the half. And the Saints came down the field and scored. And then the feeling was that, oh, shit, they're back in it. Then the next score was the Reggie Bush 88-yard.
So early in the second half, that's right.
Where Danielle Manning took an angle that I'm amazed he didn't accidentally run out of the stadium.
Well, you know what? It's a good thing that was the last time he did that season.
That's right. Yeah, he never did that again. No.
In that month.
So when you watch, if you just watch the highlights on YouTube, there's one cut up that has the home and it has the radio call, depending on, you know, if it's a big play for the Bears, you get Joniak babbling. And if it's a big play for the Saints, you get their guys. So Reggie runs in, and remember that he slowed down at the two and then did a forward flip into the end zone.
Uh-huh.
And apparently that was a thing in New Orleans that year that they called, wait to groan.
Who did?
The Fleur de Leap. Yes. I heard that, and I just went, fuck you guys.
I don't think that
14
thing really
years
got...
later, I'm just like, fuck you.
Pardon the pun, but I don't think that leap got off the ground. I don't recall it.
I don't know that he stuck it. I know that he did. No. His ass went over his head, but I don't know that he
did not stick it. No, he just flopped into the end zone, and it was unnerving.
Yes.
The one point in the game where it was like, uh-oh. But it was otherwise a rout, right?
Well, not really. So that makes it 16-14, and the Saints get the ball back again with a chance to go down and take the lead, but they're deep in their own end. And they have a third and relatively long inside the 10. And you can hear Troy, even on the highlights, you can always catch like the end of what Troy's saying, goes, they need to, it's very, John Shoup would be very proud of Troy. He goes, they need to get a couple of yards here to set up the punt. Give themselves room to punt. Drew drops back, looks around, panics, just wings the ball out into the flat. And everybody stands around, and Urlacher is making the safety sign and running at the ref and screaming and yelling.
Intentional grounding from the end zone.
Sure enough, flag comes out. 2 points for the Bears. So they went. So the score after three was 18-14 Bears.
Okay.
In a game they would eventually win 39-14. They scored three touchdowns in the fourth quarter. And those three touchdowns, two of them are iconic. The first one is the Bernard Berrien. It was a typical Rex pass. Bernard got behind the defensive back, had to dive so much that he mistimed his leap. He was laying on the ground when he caught the ball and then rolled the last 2 yards into the end zone for a touchdown.
I do remember that now.
Then there was a short touchdown run by Sed Benson. But then the last touchdown was the Thomas Jones where he started to the right and then said, screw this, and ran all the way back around to the left and in for a touchdown.
Okay.
And it was snowing. By then it had started snowing. In fact, I think it was snowing by the time Benson scored.
That's like, as Jim Nantz would say, a tradition like no other. Of course, it's only been two instances when the Bears clinch a trip to the Super Bowl. But when they do, it snows.
Yeah, the biggest problem with the Caleb Haney game.
Didn't snow.
Right, didn't snow. Otherwise, he'd have brought him back.
I never thought of that. But it's true.
He wouldn't have thrown an interception for a touchdown to the nose guard in the snow.
Oh, my God.
But I really don't want to think
we'll
about that.
We'll save that. Yeah, we can save it.
Watching that game, after watching the Bears try to run the ball, not even really bother to try, but with a few times they do, it was reminiscent of something. Olin Krutz was talking about that team, and he talked about the benefit of having runners with different styles on the same team. And he said, you know, everybody loved Thomas Jones. He was like everybody's favorite teammate. And then there was Sed, who was not everybody's favorite teammate. Sure. But he said that here was the thing we had. As an offensive lineman, when Thomas was a running back, you never knew what hole he was going to run to. You just blocked, and half the time he wasn't going to run where the play was designed. He was going to go the other way. He said when Benson was in the game, you knew exactly where he was going to go, and if you didn't get out of the way, he was going to run right up your ass every time.
Uh-huh.
And he said, so what they had, we had running backs who who we could lean on one or the other depending on the defense. If it was a fast, you know, reactive defense, Thomas, you know, dancing around behind the line wasn't going to work. You were just going to ram Cedric at him as much as you could. If you had a defense you could overpower,
yep,
or you could, you know, you could get flowing one way, then Thomas was great, because if he didn't see a hole that way, he'd just go the other way.
Right.
Currently, the Bears have a running back who runs like a 6'5", 40. Then they have a kick returner. They used to have a punt returner. And then whatever Ryan Nall is. That's what they've got. And then it's amazing that that doesn't work. And I do like David Montgomery. I wish they would actually use him the way I think he could. But the fact that they never bothered to get another running back. And Tariq Cohen is a useful player, but he shouldn't be.
He's a gadget. He's kind of a gadget.
He has to be your third running back. He can't be your second running back. And now he's nothing. He's just, now all he's doing is writing F-bombs on Twitter because he's sitting at home with his knee.
Right. I know
which
we're
is actually really entertaining.
I know we're dangerously encroaching on current Bears, but I just have to comment real quick. I feel the same way about Montgomery, but I always thought, you know, the thing with him is that he doesn't go down on the first hit. And I know they're not blocking for him, but it just, am I wrong to think that he tends to sort of dance? And maybe there's no hole for him to run through at all, but I find that hard to believe. I think run your ass into the line. And, like, if he's dancing, all right, yeah, it doesn't matter if he's not getting brought down by the first hit because he's already in the backfield by the time the second guy
hits. He certainly has to try to shake a lot of tackles before he gets to the line, which is not optimal for
it doesn't help that he's not running into the hole, though, I think. But
if there's a hole there. They run all the plays at the same spot. So, yeah.
All right, let's put this back in the spirit of what we do. Yes. I remember in 1981, I was collecting baseball cards like a fiend. I had a friend that had every baseball card except for Willie Montanez of the Phillies. Finally got it somehow, but it was mostly from buying the packs. But around the same time, I also collected football cards. And I remember... and this would have been the 1980 season, that for the team card, like it was in baseball, you'd have like the whole team photo. Mm-hmm. In football, it would put the leading passer, leading rusher, and I can't remember the guy's name. He was like a backup to Tony Galbraith, that some might recall as a Saints running back from their dark ages when they were just bad for three decades, but Galbraith wasn't that bad. But their leading rusher, if we want to feel, you know, better about David Montgomery, and you will. After hearing this, I think his name was Wayne Wilson, I think, in 1980, led the team in rushing with something like 335 yards. And I just remember that, looking at that card, and we had Walter Payton in his peak. I'm like, wow, that is fucking pathetic.
Yeah, that's 2 weeks for Walter. And that's your whole season.
It was a 16-game schedule already, 336 yards. They were awful forever. So we just wanted to throw that out there.
I loved the team photo on the baseball card, but you couldn't see anybody. I mean, they've got, you know, if for football, you've got what, 60 guys, but for baseball, you've got 25 guys plus the coaches on this little bitty card. But there's one from the 82, 83, probably, of the Royals, where even as a kid, you could spot George Brett from a mile away, because he has the biggest hunk of chew. It looks like he has it looks like he has a second head. There's so much coming out of the cheek. So I always love that card.
Yeah, those baseball. I remember my first exposure to Don Zimmer would be on one of those Topps cards, because he was an American League manager then, I think, for the Texas Rangers. Same thing, and he had his own little bubble, I think, in the lower right.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I didn't really. This was before he came to the Cubs. Of course, when he came to the Cubs with Jim Frey, I was delighted. But similar memory, only with Don Zimmer instead of George Brett.
Yeah, that was so. I tweeted a lot because I love it, and because there's so much wrong with it. But the Major League Brothers card with Rick and Paul Rushell.
Yeah, timeless.
Where they're in those weird baby blues that had like the number's not in the right spot, and Rick is wearing a batting helmet, And on top of it, so these two doofy looking guys, both of who were good major league players, Rick really good and Paul pretty good.
Right, just to make it to the big leagues, just to be clear, so, of course.
Topps has a 50-50 shot. They get their names wrong. Oh, Paul's name is under Rick, and Rick's name is under Paul. So I can imagine poor Mrs. Rushall is like, ooh, that's not right.
And on top of the fact that in spite of their, you know, the fact that they're both big leaguers and thus obviously accomplished, you know, athletes on some level, that picture just makes it look like someone hopped off a bus in like Sioux City, Iowa. And her large adult sons were dressed up like, you know, Ronnie Woo Woo in these uniforms. So
Paul's got the sideburns and the mustache. He looks like Edward Kemper, the serial killer.
I was going to say John Wayne Gacy, but same track. Oh, yeah. With glasses.
I don't know if he was doing clown paintings, but and then Rick, my dad Rick used to hunt on land just north of our house.
And he's from Quincy, Illinois.
And occasionally he would ask, he'd come by and ask if he could, you know, like, well, you know, would it be okay if I work my way south a little bit, if I end up on your land? And dad was like, oh, that'd be great. So he loved Rick Rushall. Thought Rick was the greatest guy. And he seemed really nice. I've met him maybe twice in my life. He seemed nice.
Cool.
But dad's big thing was always, you know, Andrew. This would just come up. You know, we'd be watching a Cub game. You know, Andrew. Rick Rushall, even though he was a big fat guy, he's pretty fast. Cubs used to, not only did he pinch hit, he used to pinch run. Thanks. This is the 11th time you've told me that, but that's great. So Rick Rushall has a hand in how I picked my favorite player as a small child. So I was 9 years old. This would have been right 1982. Maybe it was 1983. It might have been 10. The Beloit Brewers, they weren't even the Snappers yet. They were the Beloit Brewers, had just gotten baseball. And Rick Rushall, the Cubs Class A team was in the Quad Cities, I think. I think they were the Quad City Cubs.
That sounds right.
Rick Rushall is with the team on a rehab up here. So dad's like, we're going. So we head up to Beloit. So it's 9 miles from our house to the park. So.
And this is like actually at this point in Rick Rushall's career, he had been a 20-game winner in 77. He would go on to almost win 20 games for the Giants in 1988.
Yeah.
And this is sort of like he blew out his arm a couple times, I want to say. So it was really kind of at a low point. He had already achieved some great
this
success.
This was in between the – became a really good pitcher for the Cubs and the – best remembered, unfortunately, for giving up a 600-foot home run to Bo Jackson in the All-Star game.
Sure.
So dad does the thing that only my dad would do. It's before the game. We go down and get as close to the Cub dugout as we possibly can. Dad sees Rick, starts yelling. Rick Rushall, it's Mike Dolan. Rick Rushall, it's Mike Dolan.
Right. You hunted like, on my land.
Says it like 8 times. So Rick turns around like, who is this prick? And he recognizes him. So he's like, hey! He comes over and he's talking.
Nice. Awesome.
So I'm just a little kid and I'm watching him talk. And he takes my program and signs it, hands it back. He goes to hand it back and he's like, hey, he goes, is there anybody else on this team that you want an autograph from?
Is there like a Joe Carter maybe sitting on a bench somewhere?
Even better. Sean Dunstan.
Oh,
so not only does Rick disappear into the dugout to get Sean Dunstan's autograph, who comes up with him? So I'm 9, I think. Sean's 19. And he's all embarrassed because
he's brand spanking new. He's the 19-year-old kid from Brooklyn.
And he's like, hey, so this is Andy. He wanted your autograph, wanted to meet you. And Sean's like, hey, how you doing? And we had like an awkward 20-second conversation. And he was my favorite player from then on. He's still one of my all-time favorite players.
Right.
And it's all because of Rick Rushall.
In spite of all his flaws. I never knew that story. But
maybe because of his flaws. I always thought it made Sean more endearing.
Right. As you brought up in our first episode this year with Roland Harper, you think that that may have been the ultimate antecedent as to why you almost instinctively
rooted for
secondary players.
I mean, you know, when they make the movie about me, in the scene, I'll have my Bears 35 Andy jersey on.
That's right. That's
when
right.
I meet Sean Dunstan.
I like it. Yep. It's pretty much I think it's actually I think there are no continuity issues either. It pretty much almost lines up, you know, as far as chronology is concerned.
Yeah. I think that'll work. Oh, I'm sure I had that jersey by then. I just didn't wear it to the thing. Okay, I had one more thing about the title game. because I think it's – or two more things about the title game. So the Bears beat the crap out of the Saints physically the entire game. Early in the – I think it's still in the first quarter, they forced a fumble on a on a kick return. Robbie Gould kicked a field goal. Bears kick off. Michael Lewis. I don't think the Michael Lewis who wrote Moneyball.
Moneyball?
But I'm not sure. I don't want to, you know. He runs it back.
Liar's poker.
The fumble is forced by the good Adrian Peterson. The one who's never right. The one who never has been suspended for beating his kid with a stick.
Correct. The Whoopi Goldberg doppelganger.
So Sean Payton challenged the call because the ball doesn't pop out until Lewis is on the ground. However,
okay.
The replay showed that Adrian hit him so hard that before he comes down, he's already, the ball is like starting to roll down his leg.
It didn't have control.
It did look like he stopped it on his leg, but then he hits the ground, it pops up. Refs give the Bears a ball. Peyton loses his mind, goes crazy. Later in the game.
Good.
When the Bears are in during the fourth quarter, when the Bears are busy wrestling the NFC Championship away from the Saints, Adewale Ogunlia sacks Drew Brees. And as Drew is going down, Wally says, "Hey, if you'd like to just give me the ball, I will take it." It was ruled that Drew was down by contact. Lovey threw the challenge flag, won the challenge. I think the only challenge Lovey ever won.
It was not good at challenges.
So the Bears had a twofer. They won both challenges in the game.
Well, they won one at their own coach challenge, and then they won one at the expense of the opposing coach, right?
Yes. But the Bears also famously won a challenge and cost themselves. Now, this was John Fox.
I was going to say, it's John Fox here.
Remember Benny Cunningham?
Yeah, yeah.
Is ruled down just inside the one. Fox decides to challenge it. Because it looks like he hits the pylon with the ball.
Yes, yes.
But what somebody in the booth didn't bother to tell him was he was losing the ball before he hit
correct.
The pylon.
He was losing possession of
so
the ball.
So the Bears won the challenge, and they had to give the ball to the Packers at the 29.
Yeah, if ever there was a microcosm of the John Fox era.
Now, the one thing you could excuse about, it was embarrassing, humiliating, actually, but a replay showed that Mike McCarthy was going to challenge.
Right.
Anyway. So the Bears were going to lose the ball regardless. It was just so perfectly John Fox that he was the one who threw the challenge flag that caused his team the ball. Yeah.
But he didn't lose a timeout, so
there's a that's fun. Right. He's like, that's kind of a win for us. It's like, no, it's not. That's not a win for you. Well, you had another Bear-Saint matchup.
I've got a couple here, so... without even looking it up, I was pondering the Saints, and at first I was like, well, you know, we're going to have some difficulty here scratching too deep, kind of like with the Falcons, but there are some pretty hilariously awful moments in Bears-Saints history from kind of the contemporary era, so I'm not even going back that far, that I'm wondering if some listeners might might have some similar recollections. But so the first one, 1997, as any Bears fan will recall, is the year. And feel free to, of course, take this off on a tangent. I'll get back to the original point, but I'm sure we all have thoughts on the year that Mike Ditka came back to the NFL ranks after being so unceremoniously disposed of in January of 1993. In the summer of 1997, Iron Mike goes down to the Big Easy and becomes the forlorn Saints coach. Now, they weren't so forlorn like they were the first 25 years. Jim Morris Sr., of course, we all know, playoffs. He arrived in the mid-80s and actually did take – he took them to the playoffs for the first time in 87 after two decades of not even making a single playoff appearance. And
with George Costanza's favorite quarterback, Bobby Hebert.
Bobby Hebert. You know, that's right.
If some people don't pronounce it Herbert, they pronounce it Hebert, like Bobby Hebert. It's the woman sitting in the coffee shop just glaring at him like, shut up.
Love it. Yeah, absolutely. Bobby Aver, that's right. He was like a Cajun dude. Yeah. I think did he go to LSU or he was from the South? He was from like that.
He went to some knockoff LSU.
He was from the swamp. Right. So he was definitely Cajun. And so they were good for a few years and they go back into obscurity. I couldn't even tell you who their coach was between Mora and Ditka. Ditka came out of retirement. He had, been stacking cheddar, in Chicago, of course, like he always has, doing media appearances and everything else. But he had the itch and the ego was being stoked. Even at that age, he was getting pretty advanced. And as much as he's, made it to a point that he's so associated with Chicago, he took the job. And you'll recall, for all you youngsters at home that might not remember this, there was a very particular segment of the meatball fan base of Chicago that essentially swore off the Bears. We were growing tired of Wonstadt. We were kind of on the downslope. He just come off the season in which he said all the pieces were in place, and it was very much a colossal disappointment. And they were now at this point 2 years removed from a playoff appearance. And say what you want about Ditka, but the Bears went to the playoffs nearly every season he was there. Regardless, Ditka takes over a terrible Saints team. The Bears are terrible. They lost the first 7 games that year, same year the Cubs lost their first 14. It was if it wasn't for the Bulls winning their 5th title, it would have been the all-time worst season in Chicago sports, because I think the Blackhawks also didn't get win a game till the 10th game of the season. In that season, the Saints come to town in late September. Around the same time, I had a cousin in town from Ireland. My mom, I've mentioned this before, my mom is an immigrant from County Donegal in Ireland, and her sister settled in Galway, and she had a son. My cousin is a couple years younger than me. And so 1997, he's in town for a while. I'm living in the city. I've got my apartment. I've got tickets to the game. I've got some buddies going, and I am so stoked to show this guy what real football is, right? Okay. I've got several relatives and cousins that grew up in London and Ireland, and they would break my balls. Michael, you call it football, but they never kick the ball, whatever. You don't understand. This is a great game. And of course I'm 25 years old, so I'm full meatball mode. Like I am like, the hell with this foot soccer. This is the real thing. This is football, right? Can't wait to show them how entertaining it is. It's a Sunday night game. It's Mike Ditka's return to Chicago. There's all kinds of hype. The crowd is packed. And you can look this game up. I didn't, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to be right when I report that in the first half alone, there were at least 76 punts in the first half. It was absolutely mortifying.
They should have liked it. There was lots of kicking.
Well, but my point was, this is better than what you watched. And so I was, and I wasn't making that point. I wasn't that much of a meatball. I wasn't like in his face, like, oh, your game sucks. What? In my own head. All right. This is all in my own head. We're civil towards each other. We're going to go to this game and I can't wait till this guy watches some American football. And all we watched was like, run into the pile, throw the ball into the ground. Kick the ball all the way to the other side of the field, run into the pile, throw an incomplete pass, or throw the ball on the ground, run into the pile, kick the ball. I swear to God, it was one of the ugliest games. The Bears ended up losing. Neither team was good, so it was a classic, which team just sucks less. And the Saints did win, which at that point I was so frustrated with Wonstadt. And I was happy that like Ditka coming back to Chicago with his shitty team and knocking them off just sort of maybe hope at the time, perhaps would have accelerated his departure. But of course, Wonstadt held on for another year and a half. So to 1997, Bears Saints.
Wow. So I don't know what the record for most punts in a game is, but Todd Sauerbrunn punted 12 times. For 524 yards.
Wow, 524.
And Mark Royals for the Saints punted 9 times for 398 yards. It was 3-3 at the half.
Almost 1,000 yards punting, man. Oof. Going back. So I'm not wrong. My memory is consistent with the actual
defense. They combined for 21 punts. That's pretty good.
Wow. Wow. And then somehow it was Danny Werfel, their quarterback. Who was, or am I thinking of somebody else? But like, it was that's who I'm thinking of.
Heath Shuler.
Yeah, that's right. Drafted the same year as Trent Dilfer in 94 out of college. That was the famous Shuler Dilfer draft. But Shuler was drafted by the Redskins, so he was already on his second team 3 years later.
The Bears used two quarterbacks.
Meyer and Kramer, right?
Meyer and Kramer.
Yeah, that was the Meyer and Kramer year.
Kramer came in late to try to win it. And
it might have been the game that – yeah, it might have been the game.
He put the Bears up 17-13 in the fourth. But then Heath Shuler connected with Randall Hill for an 89-yard touchdown.
That's the play that's in my head. It was just the whole game was a taffy pull between two incompetent teams until somehow, Shuler sprung a play, and that was that.
The Bears fell to 0-6. The Saints surged to 2-4.
So 5 years later, I made a reference to traveling all the way downstate to Champaign in 2002, like five times, and usually seeing the Bears lose. But the first game in that season, I went down there, and the Bears had won the division the year before, 2001, and people called it a fluke, and we're going to, dispel that silly notion. And sure enough, in the first game, they just blew up against the Vikings down at Memorial Stadium in Champaign. I want to say Marty Booker had like over 200 yards. They're flying high. They go to week two. They're playing the Saints. We drive 150 miles, or I think I already looked at 150 miles or so down to Champaign. Bears get off to a big start. Now, I don't know exactly what the score was, 7-0, 10-0, but what I'm about to describe here is this otherwise sort of insignificant flub that in my head, and correct me if I'm wrong, Bears fans, but I think it stands out more than it should, much like the Cal Daniels rounding third base in 1992 before getting gunned down by a sniper and getting tagged out before the play. But in this case, with the Bears up, they're 1-0, they're up 7-0 or 10-0 early in the against the Saints. They forced the Saints to punt. Saints punt. Bears punt returner, backup running back, Leon Johnson.
Oh, yeah. Former Jet great.
That's right. Do you have any memory, Andy, of the punt bouncing off of Leon Johnson's face mask?
Exactly. Yes, I do remember it.
As
though it were turf in Cap Bozo's face mask.
Right.
Leon found out the hard way that the ball wouldn't stick like that. The ball was going to bounce off.
Right off his damn face. He's a punt returner. Yeah. We bitch about Ted Ginn, but at least he gets out of the way.
Well, maybe Ted saw that and went, I'm not doing that.
Part of the reason it kind of maybe felt so iconic and memorable is that it felt like from that point forward, the entire 2002 Bears season just sort of went sideways. Like I said, they were 13-3, may have been a fluke, but they blow out Minnesota in week one. They're beating the Saints, I think, a pretty good team. I think Jim Haslett was their coach. They were going to the playoffs around that time. And just this ball just inexplicably bounces off of Leon Johnson's face mask. It goes about 12 yards away. Saints recover, score. They blow them out, and, that's that. So those are my two mundane but still memorable Bears Saints experiences from some truly dark ages.
So I remember that. I remember where I was. I wasn't at the game, but I remember where I was when that happened, because I'm the godfather to both of my nieces. And so my younger niece, that was the day of her baptism. So my brother-in-law, very savvy, made sure that we would be in and out in time to get back by noon. Okay, Father, we're going to have to do this at 10.
Right.
Kickoff's be back at noon so we could watch the Bear game. And I got crap for, I would tell another story about my dad. So I didn't wear a tie.
You're the godfather.
Right. I wore a dress shirt and I did wear a sport coat, but I didn't wear a tie. And so I get there, I get to the church, and Dad's like, did you leave your tie in the car? No, I didn't. I think it looks good. Right. It looks cool. I got crap for that I still do. He's dead, and I still get crap from it because it comes up. Now, that brother-in-law, he's now a grandfather.
Oh, wow.
I just saw, because of COVID, we didn't go to the baptism. I saw the pictures of it. He's not wearing a tie. He's wearing a sport coat and a dress shirt. So now I don't feel
a tradition like no
18
other.
18 years later, I'm finally off the hook. But I remember, yeah. So we're back at their house, and I remember you know, it's one of those things where there's a lot of food and stuff, and we're not quite sitting down yet. We're kind of standing around. I remember standing in front of his TV. The ball hits Leon. And my mom, who even though she had two sons who played football and went to lots of football games, didn't pay any attention. You just made sure we weren't laying on the grass for too long after plays. Right. That was pretty much her only concern. She sees that happen, and she's like, oh, that's bad. Yes, that's bad. Thank you.
Astute analysis.
Thank you, Sandy, for summing it up perfectly.
That's good. You know, I guess it just speaks to how alike we are, because I'm actually the godfather for three of my nieces and nephews, and I can recall.
Well, I only have three total, so I got two out of three.
I've got 13, but yeah. Godfather for three, and one of them, I recall, was baptized in September of 2001, and this was out in your neck of the woods, out in Oregon, Illinois, and we got back to the church, or got back from the baptism, in which I was godfather. I wore a tie, by the way.
Yeah, I should have. I thought I was
not being... to show you up. But that was, remember, we got back in time to see the Bears pummel the Cincinnati Bengals earlier in the 2001 season. So I guess I could always tell my goddaughter the date of her baptism to express how devout I am, when all I have to do is find the actual date of when the Bears and Bengals played in September of 2001. So,
okay, so you ask a question. You asked if there was a coach in between Jim Mora and Mike Ditka.
Mm-hmm.
There was. There's one guy. He was an interim for 8 games in the 1996 season when they canned.
I want to guess.
Okay.
Would it be Rick Venturi?
It was. Rick Venturi, former football player at Rockford Auburn High School.
I did not know that. Now,
and then
I
he moved somewhere to Southern Illinois, maybe Taylorville, maybe? Senior year, and then he played at Northwestern.
I don't want to humiliate Rockford's finest son, but I guarantee you that if you look up Rick Venturi's career NFL coaching record, for anyone that coached him more than 20 games, it might be the worst, because he also coached the Colts in the mid-80s, and they were really bad. But awful after Mora? They bottomed out, right?
They were 1-7. He did win a game.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
He was also the head coach at Northwestern.
I remember that.
So now we got to look at that, because that's not going to be good either. Because that was the Northwestern teams that were so bad that NIU, that was the record NIU broke, right?
NIU, wait.
Oh, my God.
No, Northwestern beat NIU to break the record, I think is what it was.
But then NIU had the really long losing streak.
And they beat Northwestern?
I think they surpassed it. Now, they have since been surpassed. Northern does not hold the record. And now, of course, Northern is a mid-major football power. But,
absolutely.
Okay. Rick Venturi coached at Northwestern for 3 years. Here's a bad sign. He had as many wins as he did ties. Not don't wear a tie to the baptism. I mean, same score at the end of the game. He was 1-31. And
oh my gosh.
And that included
0-26-1
in the Big Ten. His NFL career consisted of.
So he never, I'm sorry, he never won a Big Ten game in like, what
he did
would
not.
That be like?
He did
four
tie
years,
somebody, probably Illinois.
4 years.
But,
and he only won one other game, which is non conference.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, they not surprisingly finished 10th in the Big Ten when there were 10 teams in the Big Ten all three years. So 1-31-1 is his college record. His NFL career, he coached parts of two seasons. 1-10 for the 1991 Colts, 1-7 for the 1996.
Wow. Oh my God.
So his career coaching record as a head coach,
college and pro,
3-48-1. Holy shit.
He's the poster boy for Jim McKay's agony of defeat. My
I would
God.
Guess I mean, Rockford Auburn
skier
probably
quietly in the middle of the night took the flag down.
I think when you walk down the hall in Rockford Auburn, you get to the trophy case. The Fred Van Vliet picture probably a little bit bigger than the Rick Venturi one. Probably.
Wow.
Yeah.
I mean, it's impressive. I mean, we talk about Paul Russell is fat, but he had to be athletic enough to be a major league player. I mean, you got to be impressive enough of a candidate to get hired three times to lead a team. So you have to have some leadership skills and what have you. But, it's hard not to just absolutely point and laugh.
It's incredible.
Wow.
So here's a weird thing about this. So the Saints, in their long history, they, I believe, were birthed the year of the merger, I think.
67 was their 67. First season. First official year of the merger, by the way, was 1970, first official merger. Okay. They were still AFL-NFL, which is why, in fact, Andy, the Minnesota Vikings are, in fact, one-time NFL champions, but not Super Bowl winners, and also why the Kansas City Chiefs, when they won the Super Bowl in January, it was also their first NFL championship. So that minutia aside, it was still AFL-NFL in 67. They were an expansion team in the NFL in 67.
So they've had 16 coaches. This should be a slam dunk. Who was the 16th coach of the New Orleans Saints?
The 16th coach?
Yeah.
Did they just fire somebody this season? No, it's Sean Payton, obviously.
But it's not. Because
COVID?
Sean Payton was a coach from 2006 to the present, but he was suspended for the 2012 season because of Bountygate. So the 15th coach in Saints history was former Bear offensive coordinator, or was he offensive or just offensive line coach? Aaron Cromer, who was 2-4, and they said, all right, you can't do this anymore. And then Joe Vitt got to go 5-5 for the 2012 Saints, and Payton came back.
I completely forgot about that.
So when you look at the list, because I was looking like how is Joe Vitt their last coach? Well, that's why, because it's not like Payton got fired and rehired. He simply was suspended for a year. So those two guys are the 15th and 16th coaches in history, and he's still just the 14th.
Gotcha. I like it. Who would be your favorite coach? I know you're looking at the list. I'm not, but I already have a favorite in mind.
Oh, there's so many. I mean, there's Bum Phillips.
That's mine.
So Bum gets, and not only this, when Bum gets fired, who took over for Bum for the last four games?
His son, Wade.
Wade got to be, dad got canned, I'm taking the job.
Right. It's like, are you the Saints coach or Cook County commissioner? Like, what happened here?
But it also could be. I mean, they've had a Hall of Fame head coach.
They have? Yes. Okay, it's not Bum. Bum was very good for Houston, and he was the first coach, I want to say, Bum Phillips. We talked about the Saints' first 25 years being absolute ass, or first 20 years, sorry, 20 years. But there was a point after about year 12 or 13 that Bum came to town to lend some legitimacy. I think they had their first ever 500 season in one of those years, but they still fell short of the playoffs in any event. Bum Phillips, as much as popular as he was in Houston, is certainly not a Hall of Fame coach. Can't be Jim Haslett. No. It's not Ditka. You're not going to say Ditka, are you? Because he's a tight end.
Hall of Fame. Yeah, Hall of Famer as a coach.
Okay. Which, by the way, Ditka being in as a tight end was enhanced by his visibility as a Bears coach at the time.
Right. But he was at the time.
He was the kind of a prototypical
He was the greatest tight end of all time. Either him or John. Maybe John Mackey. John Mackey. Him or John Mackey.
He got in before Mackey. That's all there. You're right. He was. So I'll leave that be. Shit. I'm out of guesses. Who's the Hall of Fame? Tom Fear.
He's big on matriculating the ball down the field, boys. Hank Stram coached the Saints for two seasons.
That's right. That's right.
1976 and 77, went 7-21. Who was the first Saints coach to win a playoff game?
Jim Haslett.
Yes.
Yeah, because Mora, he finally got them to the playoffs, kept losing, and then Haslett took them there, and we all expected them to lose, and now suddenly they won. But then he burned out.
Yes. And Mora was the first. They've only had two coaches ever
win a playoff
with
game.
A winning record. I mean, to have a career winning record with them. And it's Mora. Haslett did not. He ended up 45-51. Part of that, I think, was which hurricane was it? It was pre-Katrina.
They had
to play at LSU. That was
Curtis Benson's rookie year. That was the year, the first of those back-to-back Lovey Smith playoff teams, because the Bears played in Tiger Stadium in LSU.
Yep.
Right around that time.
And so the only two coaches to have gotten out of there with running records so far, well, Sean Payton hasn't left, but I don't think he's going to lose the the 54 games in a row he would need to get to 500. Jim Mora and Sean Payton. Now, Sean Payton, of course, is a former Bear great.
Spear Bear.
From Naperville Central in Eastern Illinois. He played in three games for the 1987 Bears. Started one.
Yep.
He was 8 for 23 for 79 yards and an interception.
He was responsible for their only loss during the three quote-unquote scab games.
So now, of course, everyone remembers the great Mike Hollinsey.
Yes.
Who piloted them to two wins. Yep. He was 28 of 52. They were doing a lot of throwing, but he threw four touchdown passes, only threw one pick. He had impressed Ditka so much. Ditka was going to keep him on the roster because they got to keep a certain amount. They kept Egypt Allen.
Glenn Kozlowski made a career out of it.
And then Hohensee shows up for the third game and says, "I'm hurt. I can't play." And Ditka's like, "Well, F you." And has to play Payton and then cuts Hohensee. He's like, "All right, screw it. You don't want to play? You don't want to play.
It was Payton and somebody called Mark something that calls itself Mark Bradley. I think they alternated snaps, but I'm still holding Payton responsible for that loss.
And then, ironically, Hohensee worked for Ditka because he was the Chicago Blitz. Or not the Blitz. What was the rush?
The Bruisers or the Rush?
That's the Rush. He was the Arena League coach when Ditka bought in to the team. So apparently they buried that hatchet.
The Arena League came out right after that strike shortened. So it came out of like 1988, 89. And Hohensee was sort of entry level. He got in on the ground floor, I should say. Mike Hohensee.
So that's great. Did you have another game? Or were those your two games?
97-02. I mean, that's pretty. We referenced the Kenny Stabler game from 1983, where Willie Gault erupted a few weeks ago. Championship game, of course, is the most positive memory. I think I've got it covered.
Okay, so I looked this up because I was just going to make fun of Ditka, and it turns out that there is a huge part of the most infamous trade in NFL history that I had completely forgotten. So everyone remembers that in 1999, Ditka did the thing that everybody like says, like, "I'd trade my whole draft for that guy." But nobody means it until Mike Ditka, who decided he was going to trade because he was basically he wasn't the general manager. It was Mickey Loomis, maybe? I forget who the general manager was.
Wayne Kuharchik or something?
But he had enough sway that he said, "We're going to trade our entire draft to get Ricky Williams." Now, admittedly, Ricky was a great football player at Texas, but it's not even that defensible to trade up to get a running back, much less to trade your entire draft to get a running back. So here's what Ditka traded to get Ricky Williams.
And before you get to that, just I want to point out that, you know, Ditka's first year in 97, they were bad, and they were actually better from the first year to the next. And they were still, I remember them being in contention going into the last month of the season. Like Howie Long was like talking up Ditka as coach of the year, and they bottomed out, but they shown improvement. So going into 99, Ditka had a little bit of currency, thinking they turned the corner. Well,
somewhere in 98, right, was the, "I think we became a team today, boys. I think we became," starts crying in the locker room. He's so excited. So he gets this brilliant idea that he needs Ricky Williams so bad, he's going to trade his entire draft for him. So he needs to find a team that wants to do it, that's high enough up. The Redskins have the fifth pick in the draft. And Ditka basically says, "If Ricky's still there at five, here's what we're going to give you. We're going to give you the 12th pick in the draft, the 71st pick in the draft," because they didn't have a second round pick. So they give their first rounder to the second rounder. Their fourth rounder was 107th. Their fifth rounder was 144th. Their sixth rounder was the 179th. Wow. And their seventh was 199th pick.
Uh-huh.
But because they didn't have a second rounder, the Redskins were like, "Well, that's not your whole draft." So they gave them their first round pick in 2000.
Jesus.
And their second round pick in 2000. In 2000, their first round pick was the second pick in the draft.
Ended up being
LeVar Arrington, who was pretty good, but not.
He had a nice career, but didn't live up to being the second pick.
Wow. So here's the part. Okay. It's like everybody remembers kind of the Herschel Walker trade and all of the, you know, all the stuff uh-huh. that the Cowboys turned it into. I'm like, well, what did the Redskins turn this into? And they started to write down the names. I'm like, wait a minute. That guy's a bear. This guy was a bear. Here's why. Because the Redskins weren't content to pick 12th. They wanted to move up. The Bears had the 7th pick in the draft.
That's the year the Bears didn't. I thought the Bears didn't have. Oh, 99. I'm sorry.
Yep, 99.
Okay. I was thinking 97 when they
So the Maya. Redskins traded. The Bears gave them the 7th pick in the draft, and the Bears got the Redskins' first rounder from New Orleans. So they got the 12th pick.
Okay.
They got their third rounder from New Orleans.
By the way, that 12th pick would have been turned into Cade McNown, I'm guessing.
Well, we'll get to that.
Okay.
They got a fourth and a fifth from Washington.
I don't mean to
And they got a third rounder in 2000. So for one pick, the Bears got a first, a third, a fourth, a fifth, and then the next year's third rounder.
This is just residual largesse from Mike Ditka, effectively, right?
So it was basically a three-team trade. But you think that's it? That's not all. Because later in the draft, the Redskins and Bears made another trade. The Redskins took the Bears' second rounder.
In 99.
Which they used to draft John Jansen, tackle from Michigan. The okay. Bears got, so that was the 37th pick. The Bears got the 40th pick from the Redskins. And then they got their fifth rounder, which was from New Orleans. So of the Ricky Williams trade, the Bears got the Saints' first round pick, third round pick, and fifth round pick.
That year, in 1999.
That year. So the Bears picked, I'm counting again on the podcast, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,
now,
7, 8,
I feel like, yeah, I feel like it's the Price is Right. I'm going to flip the, who are these picks?
The Bears drafted 13 players in the 1999 draft.
Okay. Which is Dick Geron's first draft.
First round draft pick. You were right. Now, the reason that the Redskins wanted to trade up was they wanted Champ Bailey.
Okay.
Would have been a nice bear.
Yes.
The Bears, had they stayed where they were, could also have taken Dante Culpepper.
Okay. Oh.
But they want, actually, they might have been able to pick Dante where they were sitting when they traded down.
You might be right.
The 12th pick, they took that wonderful lefty from UCLA, Cade McNown.
That's right.
The third round pick they got from New Orleans, they took Northwestern wide receiver Dwayne Bates.
Yeah.
I'm not sure which of these fourths. I guess it doesn't really matter. So the top two guys they got were McNown and Bates. But the other Bears, the other guys they took that year, some of these guys I don't remember, which is not great. Second round pick, they took Russell Davis from North Carolina.
Don't remember. Vaguely, but maybe not.
Third rounder, they took Rex Tucker. So that one worked
out. I remember. Offensive lineman.
I don't know if he was a third round value, but he was a productive player for them.
Yeah. He was starting tackle.
So that must have been their third round. They had three third round picks. Rex Tucker, Dwayne Bates, and 7 picks after they took a wide receiver. They did it again, and they took Marty Booker.
That was the wide receiver draft. I don't remember Bates, but I remember they had Marty Booker, they had Macy Brooks, and I don't know if they drafted Marcus Robinson, but he was a rookie that year. Like they were like, because that was when they brought in Gary. I don't know if Gary Croton had already been hired.
They need a lot of guys to run those wide receiver screens.
Well, they must have been hired, right? That was the off season in which the Bears completely bungled hiring a mediocre coach in Dave McGinnis, and then had to resort to an even, you know, turned out to probably be a better coach than Geron. But, and Geron brought in Croton, who, you know, for a while seemed a little bit innovative. So I don't remember Bates being drafted so high, but certainly Marcus Robinson had immediate impact, although he may have been drafted the year before. Macy Brooks and Marty Booker. Those guys are pretty good in the draft.
Yeah, Macy wasn't a 99 draft. I think Marcus Robinson was a free agent.
Is that what it was? All right.
I think.
They all played in that season, though.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fourth round, the Bears took both Warwick Holdman and Roosevelt Colvin.
Wow, two-thirds of their division-winning 2001 linebacking core, bookending Urlacher.
The fifth round, they had three fifth-round picks. Jerry Wisney from Notre Dame, that didn't do much. Kari Samuel from UMass.
He played a little bit. I mean, I remember that name.
And a running back from New Hampshire.
Oh, Jerry Azuma.
Jerry Azuma. Right? So that was an excellent pick.
Yeah, Jerry scored. He was one of the two touchdowns scored in the playoff game against the Eagles in 2001, in which they lost. The other, of course, was by local product and St. Rita alumnus, Ahmad Merritt. So, Jerry Azuma. Yeah, good for Jerry Azuma, because he was a slick dude, and he got himself into the media pretty quick after he stopped playing. So,
sixth-round pick was Rashard Cook. Defensive back from USC. I have no idea who that is.
I got nothing.
I remember this guy only because of the name. It was another wide receiver from Middle Tennessee State, Salacio Sanford.
Damn, I thought you were going to say Fabian Bones.
Oh, that would have been good. And then the final pick, they must have got tired of picking. So they just took Jim Finn, fullback, from Penn.
That sounds made up.
Like, yeah, it was fine. We'll just take him.
Take a white guy from the Ivy League.
Yes. So according to this Wikipedia,
all those picks, and they, okay.
The first 10 of them made the roster.
Yeah, we
Cook,
recognize
Sanford
a lot of
and
those
Finn
things.
Didn't. Okay. Marty Booker and Jerry Azuma both played in at least one Pro Bowl.
Yeah.
Cade sucked.
Flamed out.
Bates didn't do much.
Bates went somewhere to Minnesota, I think, after the.
So
Bears.
Of all those picks. Got about as little as you could get out of.
So that was,
picks. But Rex Tucker, Marty Booker, Warwick Holman, Roosevelt Colvin, and Jerry.
That was towards the end of this 15-year period where the Bears had decided to operate without a general manager after they fired Jerry Venisi, who had succeeded Jim Finks, the architect. Venisi got fired in '86, and Ditka cried again. Sorry, Mike, I got to point it out. Because they were apparently good friends. So between like 1986 and until they hired Jerry Angelo prior to the 2001 season, 15 years, they didn't have an actual general manager. They had a director of scouting or personnel. So
they had
in the beginning,
a
it was
vice
Bill
president.
Tobin.
Vice president of player personnel.
I know who it was. First, it was Bill Tobin, then Rod Graves, and then Mark Hatley.
Yes, Hatley.
And
this
then,
was a Hatley.
And Hatley that was a Hatley draft in '99, which illustrates beyond measure that you should probably have somebody more competent. Yeah. If they're given that many draft picks, that's an opportunity. Yes. I mean, especially in the NFL, third, fourth, fifth, there's value there, as evidenced by them striking. By getting lucky and getting Warwick Holman and Roosevelt Colvin in the fourth round. I'm surprised neither of those guys were Pro Bowlers. They were good for a while.
Yep. The director of pro personnel for the Bears that year was current Vikings general manager Rick Spielman, who is best known for two things. Chris Spielman's brother.
Yep.
And he puts his shoes on before he puts his pants on.
For fuck's sake, what is wrong with him? Are you serious?
Yes. That was in a Sports Illustrated profile of him. He puts his shoes on before he puts his pants on. And that's all I'll ever remember about Rick Spielman as long as I live, is that the fucker can't even figure out what order to get dressed in. But,
can you imagine just, like, looking at yourself, like, in a full-length mirror, like, in a hotel bedroom, and, like, you've got, like, loafers on yep. in your underwear? Like,
time for the pants!
That would be the time to question your life decisions, I would think, but...
So, yes, the head coach that year, Dick Duran, offensive coordinator, Gary Croton, quarterback coach, John Shoup.
Yep. Who got the promotion.
Greg Blotch.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't Greg Blotch used to put bullets in guys' lockers?
That's what it's first, it's the first thing we both think of. Yeah. That was even considered problematic then.
Yes. The offensive line coach was made famous last year for his appearance on Hard Knocks, Bob Wiley.
Oh, okay. Okay. I thought you were going to say Harry Hiestand, who was a coach from way, but he was a Wonsack coach that came back, I think. Yes. Maybe not.
And he was the guy who very clearly got fired for telling Matt Nagy, these run schemes don't work. We can't block anybody this way.
Is that right?
Yes.
Oh, man.
And then, so they give it to Juan Castillo, who was a defensive line coach. No. So Juan Castillo had been the offensive line coach for the Eagles for a long time, wildly respected. And then they needed a defensive coordinator, and they made him the defensive coordinator. The offensive line coach became the defensive coordinator. Surprisingly, it didn't work.
Get out.
Amazing. I don't know if that was Andy Reid or not. It might have been. So there you go. Oh, yeah. Oh, there's the whole roster from the 99 Bears. That was quite a group.
Oh, just injected into my veins.
The quarterbacks were Shane Matthews, Cade McNown, and Jim Miller.
Jim Miller.
Running backs Miller included helped, yeah. James Allen, Curtis Enos, and Edgar Bennett.
They still had Enos, still had Bennett. Wow.
Wide receivers, Dwayne Bates, Marty Booker, Curtis Conway, Bobby Ingram, and Marcus and Robinson, Salacio Sanford, although I don't think
I have no recollection. In the category of things that I know happened because I personally witnessed, though you might say I'm full of shit, is in that season I saw Cade McNown throw 4 touchdown passes against the Lions.
Oh, yeah. I still think if Cade hadn't separated his shoulder against the Eagles, he'd have been a star.
Well, and to be fair, I think 3 of those were like these underthrown tosses or jump balls that Marcus Robinson, because Robinson was kind of incredible.
Yes, I was way off on Marcus Robinson. 4th round pick in 97.
97, okay. So he took a while to make the roster. Nobody knew who he was till 99. It just seemed like all of a sudden they had these receivers in 99. And you referenced Croton. And we may have talked about it when we did these podcasts last year, but he really was innovative early on, and then he was never able to adapt when everybody else adapted. I swear he introduced the wide receiver screen into the NFL, which nobody knew how to defend the first few weeks.
Yes, and he ran it all the time until all of a sudden everybody was getting lit up because it was
got
the
to
same
the point
play.
That. Within 2 years or 3 years, like long after Gary Kroton was gone, that the Bears were the only team that weren't even able to run that play successfully after having been the first team to introduce it. But their first game was against the Chiefs, and they kind of like jockeyed in Shane Matthews and McNown, and the Chiefs coach was Gunther Cunningham, and I just remember like everybody making fun of him after the game, sports radio, everything else, because he was like frothing mad at all these Mickey Mouse plays that Gary Kroton was, you know, throwing out at them. And oh, we thought we were on top of the world back then, Andy. Before,
so
you know,
the tight ends, one of them was
John Allred.
Yes, John Lynch's brother-in-law, John Allred.
The sort of post facto first pick in the 97 right, draft, and they didn't have a pick.
They didn't have a first round pick. Yes.
Gave it up for Rick Meyer.
Offensive linemen included Blake Brackermeyer, Olin Krutz, Todd Perry, Rex Tucker, Chris Villarreal, Casey Wigman, Big Cat, and Jerry Wisney. Defensive linemen Ken Anderson, probably not the one who used to play for the quarterback for the Bengals, Shane Burton, Jim Flanagan. So, you know, defensive linemen. Fullback tight end.
Correct.
Brian Robinson. Clyde Simmons, who was strangely productive for them.
Clyde Simmons was an old Eagle, right?
Yes.
He was at the end of his career.
And everybody thought he was washed up, and he played really well for the Bears.
God, I'd forgotten that Clyde Simmons played for the Bears.
And the linebackers included guys like Keith Burns. I don't remember Keith Burns. Rosie Colvin, Warwick Holdman.
Yep.
The last man to wear number 54 before Brian Urlacher, Ricardo McDonald.
I remember Rico McDonald.
And Barry Minter.
Do you remember Rico McDonald put a hit on Junior Seau when like the Chargers were experimenting with Seau like catching passes out of the backfield? It's kind of sad now that I think about it, considering how Seau's life ended. But it was this period of time where Jim Miller was the Bears quarterback. He threw for like 800 yards in 2 consecutive weeks. One was a very upsetting overtime loss to the Vikings at home, at which I was at, which Chris Boniel totally missed a makeable field goal in overtime. The next week, Miller throws for like another 400 yards. And in that game, though, San Diego called a play down by the goal line for Seau to score, and McDonald put such a lick on him. And Seau bounced right back up and got in his face to kind of prove that he wasn't affected by it. But it was, now that I think about it, I think Rico McDonald killed Junior Seau. So
he may very well have.
Yeah. Sorry to bring it up.
So I have a Chris Boniel anecdote.
Okay.
I don't remember what year it was. He was still with the Cowboys. And late in the fantasy season. May have been the championship game. Maybe not. But I know that I went into a game down 20 points on Monday night. The only player I had playing was Chris Bonyol, as Summerall, Pat Summerall would say, Bonyol. He kicked 7 field goals. Scored 21 points.
Oh, wow.
Yep. And so I'll always remember that.
That had to be before. It was before he was with the Bears.
Yes. It was quite a special team crew on the 99 Bears. Chris Bonyol, Patrick Manley, and Todd Sauerbrunn, who we know because Todd punted 12 times.
Right.
Defensive backs, Ray Austin. Don't remember him. Tom Carter, formerly of Notre Dame. Terry Cousin. Walt Harris. Remember, Walt's agent said 70% of the world is covered with water. Or the other 30% is covered by Walt Harris or whatever.
Stealing the description about Gary Maddox. And Walt Harris probably was one of the – just to show you how horrible the Wanstead era was, he was probably their best first-round draft pick, which really isn't saying much.
And Tony Parrish was a safety on that team.
Was there a Darren Lewis on that team, or is that another Bears team?
Because there was the old Cub.
Who Dusty named his son after, I believe. But there was a Darren Lewis for the Bears, who I remember this happened, and I think it was 1999. It could have been 1997. Just some of that abyss of awful Bears once that early Geron years. But this other Darren Lewis, he was a little running back punt returner, and he did something like he fumbled a ball or he loafed after it, and Todd Berger, who was the aforementioned lineman, I think, on the guard on the 99 Bears, basically, like, knocked him down on the field. Like, the cameras kind of caught him just getting in his face. So, just so many awful memories of those Bears teams.
Yeah. I don't see Darren Lewis, but Glenn Milburn played on the 99 Bears.
Oh, okay.
They could use him now as a run back.
That's right.
So that's quite a trip through Bears Saints history.
I'll say.
And so how did we know that? This is bad. I didn't want to read this. So there's a paragraph in here about the coaching search prior to the 90, after the 98 season, so before the 99 season.
And once that was finally gone.
Yes. Here were the candidates that the Bears interviewed. Sherman Lewis, Joe Pendry, Dave McGinnis, Dick Geron, and Gunther Cunningham. And these were, and Jim Haslett. They also interviewed Jim Haslett. But they also got permission, but didn't interview two guys, Brian Billick and Bill Belichick.
They didn't get permission to interview Belichick?
They got permission. They didn't interview them.
Wow. Both of those guys took teams to the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Both are actually pretty good coaches. Yeah. Wow.
Although I can't imagine Belichick working for Mike McCaskey. I don't think that. I think he'd have quit. Tenure might have been shorter than his one-day tenure with coaching the Jets.
Belichick had a high price. Belichick actually was probably the highest-priced assistant coach. He was the Minnesota coach that got greedy and tried to get points before the end of the first half in the NFC Conference championship game against Atlanta that ultimately resulted in Gary Anderson missing his first field goal of the year. But it didn't hurt Billick's job prospects because he was one of the top prospects that season, and there was no way the McCaskies were looking at that level.
No.
But they got permission, huh?
Yeah.
Lovely. Lovely.
Well, we got Dick Geron.
That's right.
That was great.
Dick
another
Geron.
Another guy who, a very likable man.
Yep.
Who just wasn't like a very good coach.
Right. And, although he got two more chances, though. He kept getting jobs after he got the Bears.
Oh, like Nagy won't get another chance.
He will. Nagy's
although, honestly, Nagy's going to coach the Bears for the next 10 years. So
he might.
Anyway, both of them coach of the year.
That's right. 2001 Bears, baby. Never forget. Never forget.
And at least, you know, and Dick, you know, won one more game. He was 13-3. So.
Well, there you have it.
All right. Well, I think we've beaten the Saints and the Bears to death, but that was fun.
I think so. Yeah, no, it was more fun than certainly the Falcons. The Saints somehow really provided some material. I don't even know who the Bears play next week, but
it's the Tennessee Titans. And the only thing I remember about that was they won an overtime game against the Titans on a safety.
Yes. Oh, we'll talk about that. I remember that. I remember where I was when that happened. Not that there are any rules to this, but I assume we'll be talking about the Houston Oilers a little bit too. If it comes up, and it probably will, because Earl Campbell was one of the probably strongest competitors for supremacy.
Actually, we might talk a whole hour about the year that Jeff Fisher had to coach the Tennessee Oilers in Memphis.
You know what? I like that. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Well, we'll do that next. Everybody can look forward to that next week then for Bears Titans.
Sounds good to me.
So, all right. Well, thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Andy.
Go Bears.
Talk to you then. Go Bears.
Many of us have herpes.